Hello there, and thank you for downloading the Agendas podcast from the 27th of April. And on the programme today, nearly 6 weeks after Dubai Police launched a campaign to crack down on late-night bikers and motorists, residents around Arabian Ranches 3 say they're still struggling with noise pollution. We heard from some of the people suffering in Arabian Ranches. Meanwhile, musician Ed Sheeran has taken the stand to defend himself against an accusation his smash single Thinking Out Loud copied a classic Marvin Gaye song. So is there a copy infringement case to answer? We heard from musicologist Joe Bennett from the Berklee College of Music. Plus, scientists have figured out a way to print vaccines, something they say could save millions of lives in far-to-reach places. We heard from one of the report authors. Meanwhile, one of the biggest travel events in the region is kicking off on Monday. Dane Swindles went down to the launch of the Arabian Travel Market to find out the top travel trends for 2023. And scientists at New York University Abu Dhabi have figured out a way to stimulate appetite through an ingestible electronic device that can control hormones. We heard from one of the inventors, Professor Khalil Ramadi. Plus, the team from Dubai Calendar joined us on the programme to give us an update on everything that you can get up to this May. Hello there. Welcome back to The Agenda. Now, it's been nearly 6 weeks since Dubai Police launched a campaign to crack down on late-night bikers and motorists. The delinquents are making life a misery in some Dubai neighbourhoods, including Arabian Ranches 3. Now, Brigadier Jumai bin Suwaidan, who is Deputy Director of the Traffic Department at Dubai Police, has admitted that the problem is getting worse and says that it reaches a peak in the winter and spring months. But just how bad is the problem? Now, we've been sent this recording of one bike whizzing past. So you can imagine how, if you heard that in the middle of the night at around 3 a.m, just how that would affect you. And it's a very short clip, but you can imagine how, replayed over hours in the dead of night, that could really prevent you from getting the sleep that you need. And these residents in Arabian Ranches 3 says that's exactly what's happening to them.
Me and my family, we moved here in February. Unfortunately, during the first week, we got a surprise by motorbike races during the weekend nights. The noise was so loud and it feels like there's a machine inside our bedroom and it's constantly roaring from around 2:30 a.m. to 4:30 a.m. And the disturbance isn't just affecting us and one of our neighbors. She decided to resign her contract after she moved in only 1 week. And we have a new neighbor and she moved on Saturday and she experienced the same unwelcome surprise that night.
Me and my family moved to Arabian Ranches 3 and we were really excited about the house. But shortly after, we realized every night there were motorbikes speeding down the highway and they were making an extremely loud noise. It really stops me and my family from sleeping on many nights and I hope we can find a way to resolve this issue.
We understand our homes are really near to the highway and we expect some car noises. But the intensity of those motorbike races is beyond anything that we expect. And I'm sure that their speed is so high. I feel that it's not, they're not on the road. It feels like they're inside our house.
Now, to tell us more about her experiences, earlier I spoke to Kate Tooby. Now, she's a resident of Arabian Ranches 3 who ended up getting other residents together to try to solve the issue in her neighbourhood. I actually spoke to her about 6 weeks ago, but I wanted to catch up with her again to see whether anything had changed. Sadly, the situation was that it has not.
During Ramadan, they raced every single night. And the racing was prolonged. It was larger groups. They came back with a force, I would say. I'm pretty sure the message had got out to them that we'd been complaining because we follow some of their social media accounts and we could hear them essentially laughing at us for trying to challenge them to leave the road and trying to raise awareness of the situation. We've got their social media videos of them actually essentially just saying that they don't really care. It's just a bit of fun. There's nothing wrong with them enjoying being on their bikes, which is crazy because at 4 o'clock in the morning, there is something really wrong with them being on their bikes.
For those who didn't hear my first interview with you before Ramadan, can you give me a little bit of an outline of this noise pollution that you've been experiencing over the last 5 years?
Yeah, essentially an organized gang of motorcyclists with a couple of leader cars as well have been creating a nightmare for the residents in the villa, Arabian Ranches 3, Arabian Ranches 2 and Layan, and even as far up to Town Square. We've formed a support group. We've now come together with three other communities. We've now gathered evidence ourselves, which we've submitted to the authorities. And despite the fact a public campaign was launched by the authorities to raise awareness of the noise levels caused by these kind of pesky motorcyclists, 4 or 5 weeks has gone since the campaign started. No progress has been made. And in fact, the situation's worse. I can't believe it, but it is.
So some people might say, look, we live in an urban area. There's motorways near your home. It's to be expected that you're going to be disturbed by traffic noise. What would your answer to that be?
I think traffic noise is fine, but we're talking about regular noise going up to about 92 decibels. And we've invested into sound recording equipment and to monitor the noise levels. So we know that we're within our rights as per the UAE law to actually complain about this noise, because the levels are far, far above what is legally deemed acceptable by the law of the UAE.
Plus, it's the timing that seems to be the most disturbing for you.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no excuse to be terrorizing neighborhoods with noise between 3 and 5 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes it's 1 a.m., sometimes it's 2, sometimes it's 4, sometimes it lasts for 2 hours, sometimes it lasts for 4 hours, which is what we have seen, unfortunately, the pattern that was going throughout Ramadan. More cyclists come out on the road and then they go and then more join and they take it in turns to kind of bomb up and down, pull wheelies and stunts and just make a general nuisance of themselves.
So what type of impact is this having on the residents that you've spoken to, the residents that you've banded together with?
Different health problems. We've got people who are sleep deprived. We've got people who've been suffering from insomnia. And insomnia at quite a serious level now, where people are having to resort to taking sleeping pills to be able to get to sleep at night. It's actually having to chemically dose themselves in order to not hear this noise. We've even got people who have just moved into Arabian Ranches 3, for example, and have literally just moved out 4 weeks later because they've actually had such a shock when they have gone to bed at night and heard the noise, and they've spoken to the local residents and they've confirmed this is an ongoing problem and it has not yet been resolved.
The problem is that all the advice that anyone that I could give you, you know, wear earplugs, choose a bedroom if you have that choice further away from the road, none of those sort of are long-term solutions. I mean, I wouldn't want to put earplugs in with children in the house, for example. You know, you want to be able to hear your babies if
Absolutely.
They wake up.
Yeah.
So there just doesn't seem to be a solution. And while people who are renting can move out, for homeowners, they don't have a choice, do they?
We feel very much kind of stuck here. For those people who've bought the houses, the D54 was a road that had not yet opened. It was a road that was under development for many, many, many years. It was used constantly as a racetrack before it was actually opened. And we thought, actually, when it opens, they'll stop racing, because then it really will be against the law, because that will be a live active motorway.
So you're ending up with this cat and mouse game where the police are trying as hard as they can to stop them. But the problem is that you have these lookout cars, which means that they can all drive off and disappear before the police arrive. What is it about this road that they like so much, do you think?
It looks a bit like a racetrack. I mean, it is endlessly straight. It has no speed calming measures up it at all. It has very few exit roads leading off it, apart from Global Village and a service station. It is a very, very, very long road. It's lit very beautifully. It's got a very nice surface. It's got a very good quality tarmac. It's great for people filming themselves doing dangerous stunts and posting on social media. And it's access to the huge arterial roads for them to disappear off quickly. which is the Al-Qudra Road town square up that way, Sakeem Road down into the city, and also the Al-Ain Road. There's a massive new interchange there. So any high-speed bicycle has got the perfect exit and entrance points to get onto a road and essentially not get caught by the police.
That is Kate Tooby. Now, she lives in the Arabian Ranches 3 area, and she has banded together with other residents to try to solve that issue of noise pollution in her neighbourhood. Now, is that something that is affecting you? We'd love to hear from you. Do get in touch, 4001, or you can WhatsApp us, 04871 5500. We've had a couple of messages come in already on those numbers. This person says, noise, I can empathise, but my problem is helicopters. Over Jumeirah 3. I feel that they're flying 7 days a week, 9 hours a day at a noise level of 70 decibels, whereas the recommended maximum is 40. None of the authorities, this person says, will accept any responsibility. I'm mostly confined to my house with no escape from this horrendous noise, and it's driving me crazy. Meanwhile, this person says we need to deal with this issue in the Greens and the Springs, that is the car and motorbike noise. Basically, the revving and racing along Abdullah Omran Tarayam Street and First Al Kail Street towards Springs is ridiculous. Most of the vehicles seem to congregate at Zabil House each night, and lots of the residents have raised complaints, but no action is being taken, and it probably won't be until a major incident happens. Well, that is the view of that person texting in. Interested to get your views, whether or not you have also experienced that level of noise and whether it's bothering you as well.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Yes, welcome back to The Agenda. Now, Ed Sheeran has taken to the stand this week to defend himself against an accusation that his smash single Thinking Out Loud copied a classic Marvin Gaye song. During the court case, lawyer Ben Crump suggested that Sheeran copied the 1973 hit Let's Get It On, which was co-written by Ed Townsend. Now, it's actually his heirs who are suing Ed Sheeran, who denies any copyright infringement. Instead, Sheeran's lawyer argues that both songs are distinct from each other and that no artist should be allowed to monopolize commonly used musical chord progressions. Now, this latest trial comes 1 year after Ed Sheeran was cleared at a trial in London of claims that he copied his hit song Shape of You. So let's talk about those musical building blocks and whether they count as copying. Earlier, I spoke to Joe Bennett. He's a musicologist, a writer, and a researcher specialising in the analysis of popular music and songwriting at the Berklee College of Music in the States. And I asked him what he thinks about this case.
Well, normally as an academic, I'm very equivocal about these things, you know, can see both sides, analyze everything. Everyone's got a point of view. Uncharacteristically, I'm absolutely on Team Ed for this one. This is a ridiculous copyright infringement lawsuit. It should never have got as far as a Manhattan courtroom, and it should absolutely have been thrown out. I believe that the Sheeran parties did file a motion to dismiss or request one, but clearly it didn't go through because we are now at jury trial and Ed is giving evidence this week.
Why do you think so many songwriters or so many estates seem to be going after him for copyright?
Well, it's not just him, of course, but there is a particular reason that it's Ed Sheeran. So obviously he's commercially successful. So you don't go after someone who is not commercially successful because you're not going to get a settlement out of them. Relatedly, the songs are very high profile. But also the kind of songwriter Ed Sheeran is on a musical level, it's very accessible material. It's often sort of major key. It's uses very simple melodic phrases. And that's part of the reason he writes such successful hits. Short melodic fragments, very hooky, very memorable. You can often whistle an Ed Sheeran song after you've heard it on the radio once. And part of the reason for that success is that he is dealing in, I don't want to say tropes because he's a really fantastic creative songwriter, but he partly uses very familiar elements of popular music construction, what we might call the building blocks of popular music, commonplace styles, chord sequences, chord changes, and makes them into something new. What this case is about is four chords. There's a four chord sequence. It's not exactly the same between the Marvin Gaye song Let's Get It On and Ed Sheeran's Thinking Out Loud, but it is a similar chord sequence. But the reason that this is a ridiculous trial, in my opinion, is that this is a really common chord sequence. It's kind of a beginner level chord sequence that's known to most musicians. And in fact, Sheeran's lawyers mentioned in the court documentation that it appears in beginner guitar books, saying, if you're looking for some nice chords to write a song with, here are some really simple ones. 1, 3, 4, 5 chords built on the major scale.
So you mentioned there that this is a chord sequence that appears fairly frequently. Can you give me other examples for where you can find it?
Yeah, let me grab a guitar and I'll just explain a little bit of the underlying music theory of what this is about. So Think It Out Loud is in D major. This is a chord of D. And it uses this chord sequence of D in inversion, which means it has a rising bass line, then chord 4 of G, and then chord 5 of A. And the intro goes something like this. And then it loops around. The Marvin Gaye song is actually in a different key. It's in the key of E flat. And it consists of chords of E flat, G minor, A flat, and B flat. But if I transpose it into the same key as Thinking Out Loud, you can hear that there's some subjective similarity. So here are the four chords of Let's Get It On. It sounds kind of similar to. When you play them at the same tempo and in the same key and with those same rhythmic values. But this was a commonplace chord sequence even when Let's Get It On came out. So what I've done is I've prepared a bunch of audio excerpts of songs that predate and post-date Let's Get It On that demonstrate really that this is just the kind of thing that songwriters like to do. This is a much-loved chord sequence. So here for comparison is Let's Get It On. Here's Thinking Out Loud.
When your legs don't work like they used to before, and I can't sweep you off of your feet.
So I've digitally manipulated this audio so that everything plays back at the same tempo and in the same key, makes the comparisons easier. So let's get it on. Here's Van Morrison, Have I Told You Lately That I Love You?
Have I told you lately that I love you? Have I told you there's no one above you?
Let's get it on.
You can hear it. As you play each song, your brain gets better at picking out the chords and you can hear the similarities.
This is a song called Wolves by Garth Brooks.
Charlie Barton and his family stop today and say goodbye.
This is another Garth Brooks song. He loved this chord sequence so much he used it twice.
Sometimes I thank God for unanswered prayers.
This is a song called Pages of Life by Desert Rose Band.
Now there's nothing left to say.
This is the Beatles in 1967 with You Know My Name, Look at My Number.
You know my name.
Going back to the turn of the millennium, this is Shania Twain, Still the One.
We might have took a long way. We knew we'd get there someday. They said, I bet.
A little faster than it was originally there, just to keep it in time. Here's Lionel Richie, Stuck on You.
Stuck on you. Got this feeling down deep in my soul that I just can't lose.
So in each case you can hear that ascending. Those four chords in a two-bar loop. Here's Michael Jackson, Man in the Mirror. So it's really clear that lots of songwriters like doing variations on this chord loop. 1, 3, 4, 5. And it's such a simple musical idea that it's easily possible. Well, the evidence demonstrates that it's certainly possible that songwriters could come to this commonplace idea independently of each other. Now, a lot of these songs are really well-known hits, and yet no one's ever accused these songs of plagiarizing each other, because until now, everyone's accepted that this is a commonplace chord sequence and one of the basic building blocks available to songwriters.
Fascinating stuff there from Joe Bennett. He's a musicologist, writer and researcher specialising in the analysis of popular music and songwriting at the Berklee College of Music in the United States. I spoke to him for about another 15 minutes. We got really into the detail of how artificial intelligence, how copyright is going to be affected by artificial intelligence. That, though, will have to be an interview for another day.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there and welcome back to The Agenda. Right, let's take a look at an international story, because it is undoubtedly a time that many of us would like to forget. But if I could ask you to cast your mind back to early 2020, one of the critical challenges that the world was facing early in the pandemic was the creation of a vaccine for COVID-19. Now, we were initially told that the process could take years. Instead, it took months. But the volatile new mRNA-style vaccines came with issues of their own, with stringent cold supply chain needs leaving them out of reach of the world's poorest and the most vulnerable communities. Now, a team of researchers at the renowned Massachusetts Institute of Technology have taken a first step towards making these new vaccines far easier to administer by incorporating them into microneedle patches that could eventually be printed from a machine and then self-administered. Now, earlier producer Jennifer Crichton caught up with one of the study's authors, Dr. John Darastotle, and she began by asking him how this discovery came about.
We started this project in late 2019, and it was to be able to deliver a printer to different parts of the world to be able to vaccinate vulnerable populations against emerging disease. And actually, the one that Dr. Jaclenic references a lot is Ebola, because that was actually what was on the mind people at the time, because it was pre-COVID. So the mRNA vaccines became a lot more well-studied and prevalent during COVID-19, and we were able to incorporate those into microneedle patches. This is one of the first studies that was able to achieve that. And then we also were able to automate some of the fabrication of the microneedle patches and put that into a device. And that's the microneedle vaccine printer that we recently published on.
So in layman's terms, tell me what exactly a microneedle patch is and how it can be used to deliver vaccines.
So a microneedle patch, the ones we work with, the patches have small needles that are about 1 millimeter long, and they just are barely able to penetrate into your skin and dissolve and release vaccine. The nice thing about them is they can be self-applied. So you don't need a trained nurse or doctor to administer the vaccine via a long needle injection. You could actually do this potentially in the future once these are more well studied yourself and simply press the patch against your skin and let the vaccine be released that way.
At the start of the COVID pandemic, when people were discussing the creation of a vaccine, obviously one of the major challenges with the early mRNA vaccines was that they needed to be kept in very strict conditions under very cold temperatures and the issues that that caused for transportation. How is it feasible to take that technology and put it into a printable patch? And does it remove some of those challenges that we saw with those early mRNA vaccines?
Yeah, I mean, that's spot on. mRNA vaccines right now for long-term storage are required to be frozen. And that requires, along the supply chain, all these refrigeration devices, to keep them cold along the way, and they have to be monitored along the way, which adds to the cost of using them. And that's what we refer to as the cold chain. And so one of the like knock-on benefits of microneedle patches, once you get the vaccine into them, they're stabilized by the polymers that actually give the microneedle patch the strength that lets it break the skin. So the mRNA vaccines that are in there are kind of frozen in place in the patch, and that allows them to potentially be stored at higher temperatures as well, because they're kind of in that dry format. So in the paper we recently published, we studied them at 4C and at room temperature in our lab, which is around 25C, and they were able to be stable for multiple months that way.
So obviously these vaccines are produced as patches, as you say, that can be self-applied. But what is the mechanism of getting those patches into the world? Is it akin to a 3D printer? Is it like an ATM? How big is this machine, and what technology is required to make these patches accessible?
Yeah, I think there we're really still in the development phase. Our research now is on getting that workflow and automating these processes. And we're working currently with product designers and potential partners to come up with a device that can automate all that stuff and keep it in a confined footprint. And really, there are a lot of variables that go into that. The size of the printer can affect how many patches we make per day, like the throughput of manufacturing. So we don't really want to define that yet. It can be pretty open to whatever the needs are of whoever eventually wants to use it.
One of the key topics of discussion over the last 3 years has been vaccine equity and fairness of access. Presumably, if you can figure out a way to remove the cold chain and also to remove the need for a healthcare professional to administer vaccines, that could really answer a lot of the problems that exist in lack of vaccine access. How powerful could this technology be in terms of answering that major issue?
I think microneedle patches hold a lot of promise there, like you said, because they can be self-applied and because they can have improved thermostability. There's a lot of research that needs to be done to get them into humans right now. So I think that's the next step. Yeah, I think really our goal is to try and deliver this printer and one day have scalable microneedle manufacturing. And that's really what drove this project. The microneedle patch fabrication process hasn't really been automated before, and that was what drove us. And we're still trying to make that printer a reality.
That was producer Jennifer Crichton speaking to one of the study's authors, John Daristotle, right here on The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8. Right, in the next few days, the UAE's focus is going to firmly fall on tourism and travel. That is thanks to the 30th edition of the Arabian Travel Market. In fact, if you were listening to the Business Breakfast this morning, you'll... Now, this year, as you can imagine, the event is themed around working towards net zero. I would challenge any event not to have a sustainability sort of sub-theme this year, with COP28 due in November here at Expo City. But organisers, exhibitors and visitors are set to explore the evolution of innovative, sustainable travel trends. Now, the ATM launches today at Voco Dubai. Dane Swindles is there. Basically, the press conference started about 6 minutes ago, so he's refused an interview with us. Outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. But presumably he is listening to the esteemed officials who are launching that event. So instead, we're going to chat with producer Jennifer Crichton, who's joining me now to bring us up to date. Jen, what can we expect from this year's event?
Well, this year's ATM takes place from Monday to Thursday next week. And as you say, unsurprisingly, the theme of this year's event is working towards net zero. Now, given it is the UAE's year of sustainability and with COP28 very quickly approaching, it's a theme we can expect to see reflected in every aspect of the event, from sustainable hotel, food and beverage exhibitors through to examinations of transport technology. Plus, the event's organisers have also unveiled a dedicated sustainability pledge, not only to make ATM ATM even more sustainable, but to achieve 30 long-term goals aimed at working towards net zero themselves. Danielle Curtis, Exhibition Director for the Arabian Travel Market, says that's an exciting new approach.
This year, our theme for Arabian Travel Market is working towards net zero. So you will see it carried across all of our show stages with key content, insights, knowledge, learning with the experts around the world as they come together and join our panel discussions and many seminar sessions at ATM over the 4 days of our event.
Sustainability is one thing, but there's no doubt that there's also a thirst for increased travel following those pandemic-induced grounded years. Curtis says traveller numbers are certainly picking up fast.
With traveller confidence, demand and activities fast approaching pre-pandemic levels, obviously there's an appetite to travel once again and get out and see the world, which is fantastic to see. You can only see by the numbers posted by Dubai Tourism earlier this year, where they saw 3.1 million international arrivals just in the first 2 months of the year. So there is confidence, there is the appetite to travel. You can see internationally and further afield, Thailand, for example, reporting 1,500% increase year on year. And that's just for their January arrivals alone. You know, look, it's been a tough 3 years for the travel industry. And it's really good to see the reporting of numbers coming back to pre-pandemic. So it's safe to say that the industry is back, the industry is returning back to pre-pandemic levels. And of course, I think for 2023, many cities and destinations will be exceeding those volumes.
And of course, that's a sentiment that was shared by Adil Alreda, COO of Emirates, this morning on The Business Breakfast.
As you would have seen, the aviation sector, the tourism sectors have been doing very well thanks to the policy of Dubai and UAE here. The number of passengers who use Dubai airport, number of passengers who came to the city really have exceeded our expectation. So I think it is like many other sectors I've seen and some other entity have already announced a very positive result, higher than what they were expecting, whether it is last year performance or the last couple months performance.
Now, I actually spoke to Danielle Curtis a couple of days ago now, and one of the really interesting things that she told me, because I wanted to know about the top travel trends for 2023, and she told me that, first of all, Dubai was proving incredibly popular, and she wasn't just saying that because she was talking to me in Dubai. She pointed out, you know, it's second in the world, it's in one of the top five cities in the world for popularity. She also highlighted that Thailand is proving incredibly popular, but get this number, 1,500 times more. That's how many more bookings that they received this year compared to last. Now, admittedly, I think Thailand was only just opening this time last year, or I might have got that wrong. But just to give you a sense of just how popular Thailand is, it's completely crazy. She says the Maldives has enduring popularity, but she had a really intriguing top tip for the country that she thinks is going to be new and popular this year. And that's according to Forbes as well. And apparently it's Armenia.
Do you know, I was going to say, is it Armenia?
Yeah.
I've heard so many people recently saying that that's where they're sort of their hit list this year is.
I literally know nothing about the country. I had to go home and Google it to find out more. She also said that Georgia was proving very popular, in particular from here, because it's visa-free travel and it's within 4 hours. So interesting stuff. If you're looking for a possible holiday destination for the next Eid, then maybe Armenia is the right option. Meanwhile, economists are also suggesting that this growth in travel is going to be a key financial focus for the year ahead.
That's right. And it's not entirely surprising. This is, in truth, the first year since the turn of the decade that many people have been able to travel freely, with tourists from major markets like China only now able to leave their home nations. Ed Ball is an economist from Emirates NBD, and he says that picture presents a significant opportunity for travel-focused economies like ours.
The tourism sector here in Dubai looks to have gotten off to a pretty strong year. We've had 3.1 million visitors for the first 2 months of the year. And then by February, the number actually exceeded pre-pandemic levels. So we had 1.6 million visitors in February alone. That's up 7% from 2019. So a strong recovery that has been underway and now finally exceeding those pre-COVID kind of levels. When we look at the breakdown of visitors, it's from kind of the traditional core markets of visitors for the UAE, for Dubai, Western Europe, a big share of that, also followed by countries in the GCC as well as South Asia. India was the single largest source of tourists with about 400,000 over January and February, followed by Russia and Oman and the UK. The great big hope for this year will be the recovery in Chinese travel. The pandemic obviously took a huge impact on the number of Chinese visitors coming to Dubai, which had been one of the largest source markets of visitors in the last decade. When we look at the numbers for the first 2 months of the year, we had 52,000 visitors from China coming into Dubai. That's down 75% on the same period in 2019. So there's still a very long way to go to recover the kind of numbers that we have been seeing before the COVID-19 pandemic. There has been some hope that they would be traveling again this year, but most surveys we've been seeing of Chinese visitors or Chinese travelers is that they're not intending to travel at the same kind of pace as we've seen in previous years.
Okay, so while we're looking at visitor numbers, this is actually a landmark year for the Arabian travel market as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. Incredibly, the event is now in its 30th year. And Curtis says, while that provides a good look at how far the event has come, this year's new sustainability focus also offers a glimpse into how impactful the event can still be in the future.
Well, we are actually in our 30th year of operation, which is a huge milestone for us. In 1994, our event was inaugurated by His Highness Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum. And at the time, we had 7,000 attendees from 52 nations. And if we fast forward 30 years, which is an amazing effort, we're now looking to host over 34,000 attendees, 2,000 exhibitors from 152 destinations, which is fantastic. So we have come a long way. This year we've unveiled a dedicated sustainability pledge. And essentially, it's in line with our own Reed Exhibition Global Pledge to reach net zero by 2040. So it's rather apt that our theme this year is working towards net zero. This theme will be carried across all of our content stages, the global stage, travel tech stage. And of course, new is our sustainability hub. It's bite-sized learning on the show floor this year. So you'll see the experts gather to share their insight, the innovative, sustainable travel solutions. And it's also going to be the backdrop for our ATM 2023 startup competition. So you'll see the entrepreneurs coming together for a sustainable travel tech pitch. So watch this space to see who wins that. We also have new this year, our new Best Sustainable Stand Awards, where basically we've set out key guidelines for our exhibitors to follow and hopefully allow and enable them to make better and more sustainable decisions when they're building their stands.
That launch is kicking off this hour as we speak. And the ARN News Centre's Dane Swindles, as you said, is there keeping an eye on proceedings. So we will, of course, bring you more on that as it emerges throughout the day.
Yeah, Dane's not escaping us. He might not be able to do the sports news, but he can certainly come on and talk to us about travel instead.
This is The Agenda with Georgia Tolley.
On Dubai Eye 103.8, the UAE's number one talk radio station.
Right, let's take a look at that local story now, because scientists at New York University Abu Dhabi have figured out a way to stimulate appetite through an ingestible electronic device that can control a person's hormones. Now, the capsule is non-invasive and it acts as a precise method that could be used to modulate hunger levels and treat metabolic and neurologic diseases. Now, it's an extraordinary device. It can resist water and acidic gastric fluid in the stomach. But how does it actually work? To find out, I spoke to one of the inventors, Professor Khalil Ramadi, who's director of the Laboratory for Advanced Neuroengineering and Translational Medicine at New York University, Abu Dhabi. And I started by asking him why his team started down this path of research.
We were realizing that the existing therapies that we have for neurological disorders are really quite poor, right? We have drugs, but, you know, most of the time, 40 to 50% of patients don't really respond well to medication therapy. We do have other types of electrical stimulation therapy where we can modulate the nervous system, but these are usually done through implanted devices, which require surgery and healing, and which honestly makes them off limits for a lot of people. And so our approach was to try to take the best of both approaches, take the convenience of something that you can ingest, much like we do pills or capsules, but instead of having them deliver drugs or chemicals, could they instead deliver electrical stimulation? And really what this leverages is the fact that we have this entire network of neurons in our gut. Our gut has the second largest number of neurons after our brain, and in fact, exist completely independently. We call those sets of neurons little brain because they function and have all sorts of things that they do by themselves, which regulate digestion. But for our purposes, it makes for a perfect target where we can have something that is ingested, which is technically outside the body, right? We don't have to worry about implantation, surgery, sterility. Our GI tract is receiving things from the outside world all the time. And we can use that as a conduit to actually access these neurons in the gut.
So how does it actually work? Say I needed to have my appetite suppressed for some reason. Do I literally just take it like a tablet? And then what does it do in my tummy?
So the way that it works is that it essentially looks much like a pill that you might take that has the medication on there. So think about the size of your omega-3 capsules, the relatively large ones. Those are basically how big this is, more or less. Inside, we have a small amount of electronics, a little battery that power these things, and then you have electrodes on the outside. Once this pill is delivered, the protective encapsulation comes off once it sits into the stomach, and then it starts to release electrical signals into the stomach wall. There, these electrical signals modulate some of the neurons and electrically sensitive cells. I do also have to give one caveat. I would love to be able to say that we are currently suppressing appetite, because that I realize how big a market that would be. The current paper shows that we are actually really good at inducing appetite. And so what we can do is actually increase levels of this hunger-regulating hormone. And so, you know, ongoing work in lab is trying to see how we can tweak things the other way as well, in terms of having this pro-hunger hormone go down. But in this case, what we're reporting is that we're actually able to increase levels of this hunger hormone.
Is there at present a need for some people to have their hunger hormone increase?
Yeah, there's actually quite a few different applications. So conditions where patients either report a loss of hunger or a increase in nausea and vomiting. So things like patients undergoing chemotherapy, patients with a condition called cachexia, which can arrive from advanced kidney disease and lung disease, chronic vomiting syndrome, even hyperemesis in pregnancy, and of course, eating disorders. There's one specific subset of eating disorders called ARFID, or avoidant restrictive feeding intake, food intake disorder. And there, patients report basically not being interested in eating. And oftentimes, they can present to the emergency room just being severely malnourished. And so if we can try to enhance food uptake in any of these populations of patients, we would be obviously very excited.
And do you think that potentially you could be able to figure out the inverse? Because like you say, that would be the most extraordinary market.
So absolutely. I think it's conceivable, right? The reality is that we understand some of the biology, but not all of it. And that's just some outstanding questions that still need to be uncovered. But it is, you know, something we are really working hard on to try to see what other levers can we tweak. So in the stomach, absolutely. Can we decrease ghrelin levels? And then you can also open the door to other things, right? Much like, for example, Ozempic works on being a GLP-1 agonist. That is a whole other hormone that if we can regulate the release of through the intestine, again, using a similar ingestible electronic approach, we also could forego the injections that are required in that case.
So in my excitement to find out what this can do, I've slightly hopscotched over how you managed to make it, because that was quite a complicated process in itself, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a funny story. It's a really simple concept, right? It's you know, if I were to oversimplify, it's a piece of plastic with some metal outside. However, the GI tract is just this really complicated and tough environment to work in, right? You have things that are being released all the time, acids, bases, enzymes. The entire purpose of the GI tract is to receive food and actually break it down. And so anything you design as an ingestible needs to be able to withstand this and not break down. And two, actually function in spite of all these mechanisms trying to destroy it, basically. It's like going into a, you know, dragon's lair and then trying to actually be productive. And so one of the major issues that we found in the stomach is that it's a really wet environment and water is bad for electricity. That's why you shouldn't handle electrical outlets when you have your hands wet. And in a similar way, this water really ran the risk of actually basically preventing our device from working, of short-circuiting our electronics and preventing any of these electrical signals from going into the wall. And so instead, you know, we sort of looked to, a little bit to nature to see what exactly is out there that also has specifically designed features to handle water, to handle moisture. And we actually found inspiration in a really weird place. There's this random lizard that is called the thorny devil lizard of Australia. And because it's such an arid climate, the way that this lizard works, essentially its skin is patterned into having many micro channels, such that even if it's worth a step on a drop of water, immediately that water would wick into the channels and it'll be channeled all the way up into the mouth so they can actually drink it. And that way they sort of maximize all the moisture that they can pick up from the ground. And so, you know, we looked at that and said, well, could we design something similar where we can also kind of make our own network of microchannels in a way to also channel fluid away from where we don't want it to be and basically towards the part that we don't care. And so that's exactly what we did.
Absolutely fascinating project there. I can't wait for them to figure out a way to suppress appetite as well as encourage it. That was Professor Khalil Ramadi there, Director of the Laboratory for Advanced Neuroengineering and Translational Medicine at New York University, Abu Dhabi. Kind enough to speak to us here on The Agenda on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the UAE's number one talk radio station.
This is The Agenda
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Hello there. Welcome back to the programme. Now, it is nearly the end of the month, and I know a lot of us are always looking for things to do around town and different ways to keep the family entertained. So it has become a monthly affair that we invite the team from Dubai Calendar onto the radio. I'm delighted to say that this month is no different. Joining me right now on Teams is Alreem Alreda, who is an executive in the Leisure Events and Festivals Department of the Dubai Tourism. Thank you for joining me, Alreem. How are you this month?
Hello, Georgia. I'm good. Always good to be back on your show.
Yeah, it is fantastic to have you with us. Now, obviously, May, it starts to heat up a bit, doesn't it? We do this month by month. And for the last 6 months, I've been going, let's all take advantage of the perfect weather. And now it is going to get a little bit hot in the middle of the day. But you've still got plenty going on, haven't you? Let's talk about...
Always.
Yeah, let's talk about musical events first, shall we?
Yeah, so for Music Georgia, I think one of the really, really cool events taking place in Dubai this month is the Disney Princess, the concert. So that's taking place at Coca-Cola Arena on the 6th and the 7th of May. It will feature a show where basically all the top Disney princesses will perform more than 30 popular and much loved Disney songs. So, you know, for anyone who has a daughter and anyone that loves Disney and loves Disney princesses, this one is really one not to miss. And the best part about it is that, you know, little kids can dress up as their favorite Disney princess. So that's, you know, something super cute and super fun to be a part of and to take your families to.
It really is. And obviously, as a mother of boys, that's not one for me. But I know that for the most part, there's nothing girls like to do more than dressing up as their favorite princesses and to go to a concert. How about for the grown-ups? Something to make us laugh.
Yes, so I'm very excited to announce that the Comedy Festival, Dubai Comedy Festival, is returning on the 12th of May until the 21st of May. So that's a total of 10 days of laughter and comedy in the city of Dubai. It is a citywide event, so it will take place all over the city in venues like Dubai Opera, the Theatre, and Mall of the Emirates. The lineup for this year is just filled with some amazing comedians. You know, we have Jimmy Carr, we have Stuart Taylor, we have Jim Jeffries, Amit Tandon, and lots, lots more. So all the details are on the website, dubaicomedyfest.ae or dubaicalendar.com. I do encourage everyone listening to just check it out because it truly is, you know, one of my personal favorite highlights of the year.
Yeah, in fact, I think Jimmy Carr might have done an interview with the team from Offscript, so well worth checking out their podcast page if you want to hear that interview back one more time. Jimmy Carr, always absolutely hilarious in my view. Although you'll have to say comedy is very subjective, isn't it? They had Dubai brought in another comedian recently. Oh, Jack Whitehall. And I just, everyone here was thought he was thrilled. And I just, sorry, Jack, if you're listening, but he's not my, he's not got my, I think he's gone home. So it's all right. He's British, but he hasn't got my sense of humor. Okay, let's take a look.
That's why we have a huge lineup. It's for, you know, for a different taste.
Well, exactly.
Like you said, this is very subjective. So we have a very, very nice and a full calendar of comedy events during that time. So it's amazing.
Yeah, people from lots of different countries because we all have slightly different senses of humour. How about for the foodies? This is one I've got my eye on.
Oh, yes. So we have obviously the Dubai Food Festival, which is currently running and ending on the 7th of May. So there's still lots of time and there's absolutely so much happening all throughout the city. The main program that I want to highlight as part of the Dubai Food Festival is the foodie experiences, where basically different restaurants across the city are offering different experiences like master classes, chef's tables, experiential dining concepts, there's kids workshops and so much more. So just for me to give a few examples, we have Vietnamese foodies who are doing a masterclass on their summer rolls. We have Raw Coffee Company in El Goiz who are offering a sensory journey and experiential dining to get people to learn more about specialty coffee. There's Black Tap as well, who are offering a specific masterclass for kids on how to make their signature crazy shake. Overall, we have close to 100 foodie experiences all over the city, and it really is, I think, one of the best programs of the Dubai Food Festival. So I really do encourage everyone listening to go on dubaifoodfestival.com and check out all the amazing offerings taking place all over the city.
Yeah.
And there's something to, you know, for every taste. If you like, you know, more of the Japanese cuisine, or if you like burgers, there really is something for everyone to do.
Yes.
We have another program that I want to highlight. It's the Dubai Restaurant Week. So that's basically where 52 of the top restaurants in Dubai all participating to offer some amazing set menus at very attractive prices. So there's two course lunch menus that they're offering starting at 95 dirhams, and there's three course menus starting at 150 dirhams. So now really is the time to take your families and friends out to experience some new restaurants, or even, you know, for business lunches and meetings. This time is the best time for you to experience some or try out some new restaurants or ones that are more on the fine dining or high end.
Yeah, it's always a sort of particular pleasure to get a good deal at an expensive restaurant. And that's certainly one of the ways in which you can do it. Right. So how about if people want to look out for more activations over the next month? So is it best to download the app?
Yes. DubaiCalendar.com, I would say, is the best place to go on. We're continually updating it with new events, and, you know, as we all know, there's so much happening in the city of Dubai every day. So DubaiCalendar.com is definitely the best place to check out all the happenings across the city.
Al Reem, it's been an absolute pleasure. I hope to see you or hear from you again in about a month's time. We'll find out what's going on in the UAE in June. It'll be really hot then, so it'll be mostly indoor activities, let's be honest.
Yes. For sure. Yes.
But we'll be looking forward to it. Thank you so much, Al Reem. A pleasure, as always, to have you joining us on The Agenda. Al Reem Al Raida, Executive of Leisure Events and Festivals for Dubai Tourism. And yet, well worth downloading the Dubai Calendar app or checking it out online. The Agenda is live Monday to Friday from 10 a.m. till 1 p.m.